Good morning, everybody. This is 50241, the 27th of October. We're going to finish up sensory chapter. Still have to talk about some things for vision and then move into endocrine chapter today. All right, so one last light to turn off here, like so. And, oh, here's the sign-in sheet, just a blank piece of paper. Put 1027 on there, please, 5241. That helps me a lot. Okay, so we were about at this slide someplace, talking about the retina. We looked at the ciliary body for pulling on the lens, and that changes the shape of the lens so that you can focus on something that's really close to you. We call that accommodation reflex. And then we began to look at the retina just a little bit. Retina has these photoreceptor cells. And there are basically two kinds of photoreceptor cells. That's one way to think about it anyway. And you can see some look like a rod and some are more conical shaped. So they're what we call rods and cones. And they perform different functions and you can find them in different locations of the retina as well. So the cells that work the best are cone cells. Cone cells are located in your central vision. That part of the retina that is your central vision is called the macula lutea. And then the very center of the macula lutea is called the fovea centralis. So fovea centralis has just cone cells in it. And even all of these other neurons that are that receive light first or have light bounce off of them are pulled away from the fovea centralis so that only you have these cone cells and not bipolars and not amacrine and not nerve fibers of the optic nerve. So that gives you your best vision. So what does that mean? Cone cells are good for color vision, so you can see color, and also high resolution images. They give you a lot of fine detail so you can observe edges and shapes of things very, very nicely. But the trade-off for that is that they need bright light in order to work. So right now, maybe some of our cone cells are working, but not too great because it's a little bit dim in here. But if we were to go outside, the cone cells would be activated and you can see nice bright colors, nice shapes. Right. And then the other kind of cell are these rod cells. Well, if the cone cell is so good at what it does, why do we need rod cells? So let me tell you about the trade-off for rod cells. Rod cells, you cannot see color, and you don't have high-resolution images. So rod cell will give you grayscale, which is a little bit better than just black and white, okay, but not much better. It can give you grayscale, no colors, and it will give you fuzzy detail. So that doesn't sound like an advantage at all, but here is the advantage. Rod cells work in dim light. So you still can see some things in dim light. You just can't tell the color or have really fine detail of what that image is like. So the cone cells are in your central vision, and as you move away from the fovea centralis and macula lutea, then you might see some population of rod cells, and as you move farther away, you're going to see more rod cells. Until you get way out into your peripheral vision, there are no cone cells whatsoever. It is just rod cells. So in your peripheral vision, I don't know, maybe try this sometime. Just look at an object and have some color around you. And without changing where you're looking, try to observe the things in your peripheral vision and see if they still retain color. Okay, or maybe they turn to black and white. Well, you guys know I'm not really good with color anyway, but try that and see if you see colors with your peripheral vision. And that also will be good because then you'll get a sense of what somebody with macular degeneration has to go through. Somebody with macular degeneration loses their central vision. And so if they ever want to see something or read something, they have to read with their peripheral vision only, which is kind of strange. So it doesn't even look like they're looking at the object that they're looking at because it's only with their peripheral vision. And as a matter of fact, you could try that right now. Take your fingertips. Don't poke it in your eye, though. Put your fingertips right in the center so that you can see your fingertip, right? And you can't see anything in front of you now, right? Only your peripheral vision. So that's what it's like if somebody has macular degeneration. They just have this spot in their vision all the time. Okay, so I see a number of rows of cells. I see some nice bipolar cells that are connected to the rods or cone cells. And then I see some amacrine cells, and then I see some ganglion cells that send axons into the brain via the optic nerve. These cells are important for processing information and for gathering light so that you can see in dim light conditions. And then we even have some of these horizontal cells. So there are many different kinds of cell types, and that visual information is processed to a large degree before it even arrives in our brain. And it's kind of funny that light has to pass through all of these layers of neurons before it gets to the photoreceptor cells, which are what? Rods and cones, right? Okay, so the retina has two main layers. There's an epithelial layer that I see right here, and then a neuronal layer. The neuronal layer contains all these photoreceptor cells and the rows of other signal processing cells. And the pigmented epithelium, right, which is part of the retina, though very, very thin, is there to help get rid of the debris from rod and cone cells as they regenerate over time. So they continue to grow to replace some of the structures that we can find on the inside, and it shouldn't just build up inside the eye. Epithelium does that. It also provides some nourishment for the photoreceptor cells, and that's pretty much about it. But there are not stem cells in this epithelium, so if these rods or cone cells die, they can't be replaced, right? Because there's no stem cells in the epithelium. All right, so here is a better representation of a rod and cone cell. You can see that the cone, right, is smaller than the rod cell. Not only is the cone cell shorter, but it's narrower as well. So it can't gather. It's not as sensitive to light compared to this rod cell. And that also tells you then that the cone cell can produce a sharper image because it's receiving light from more and more segments of the world outside. If we look at a photoreceptor cell, it kind of reminds me of a neuron a little bit because we see some synaptic endings that remind me of an axon terminus. And so in these synaptic endings, you would see vesicles filled with a neurotransmitter, and that neurotransmitter would be released, okay, when these cells are stimulated. Right? So let's look at the pieces of the cell. There are basically two parts to the cell. Here is where we find the major part of the cytoplasm, contains the nucleus and the mitochondria. This is what we call the inner segment of the cell. This is not the photoreceptive end. And then we have the outer segment. The outer segment is the photoreceptive end, and it has discs. We're going to take a look at those discs, and those discs contain compounds or chemicals that are sensitive to light. And if these chemicals change their function, what could you tell me, what could you guess is happening to these chemicals when light is shined on it, if they're changing their function? Yeah, the structure of these chemicals changes, right? And so that's exactly where we're going to go. The chemicals in the outer segments of these two cells are very sensitive to light, and when lights get shined on them, some of the structures of chemicals inside them change, and that causes a change in physiology inside the cell. Okay. All right, so here are some of the chemicals that can absorb light. And we're only going to talk about rod cells. Cone cells have similar kinds of compounds, but they have different names and a little bit different shapes. Here we have a protein that we call opsin. And you could consider opsin to have a special surface area, right, that kind of looks like an active site or a receptor site. So, and what it can bind is a molecule of retinol. And retinol just so happens to have a nice curved shape, and it fits in this nice curved spot on the opsin molecule. Right. And this is in an equilibrium state. This is in a relaxed state. But when light is shined on this rhodopsin molecule, then the retinol changes conformation. Instead of having a curved or hook kind of conformation, it straightens out. And that can be done with just a rotation around a couple of these bonds. And when it straightens out, guess what? Can't fit in that active site on the opsin molecule, and we're going to see what happens next. All right. So then even the retinol molecule can even jump off of the opsin molecule, right? Then it has to be recombined. This is what we call a bleaching reaction. So if you were to look at bright light and then look away, you would still see an image of that bright light afterwards because, right, this retinol has to go back to its normal conformation and rejoin with the opsin molecule, right? And until all that happens, you will see some after image. Doesn't happen all the time, but for a very bright light, it does. Okay. So this bleaching reaction then causes changes in permeability of the membrane of those rods and cone cells that results in action potentials in the ganglion cells, which were what rose away from the photoreceptor cells. Okay, well, maybe I'll come back and read these slides, but I just want to talk to you about these figures first. Okay, so cyclic GMP is an important compound. Have you ever heard of another molecule that's kind of similar to cyclic GMP? Yeah, cyclic AMP. And what have you known cyclic AMP to be? A second messenger, right? And it's got a really special shape because it's cyclic in form. Well, GMP in its cyclic form is sort of similar. It has a very specific shape, and it can bind to a sodium channel. And this sodium channel right here is a ligand-gated sodium channel. So that when cyclic GMP binds to it, it opens up. And there's usually we'll talk about when cyclic GMP is there. Okay, so cyclic GMP will cause this ligand-gated channel to open up, and it's sodium. And you know sodium to be high on the outside, low on the inside, and the electrochemical gradient will draw it inside the cell. So, and this is under dark conditions. Right, so sodium enters the cell when there is no light. And what do you know about sodium entering a cell? What is it going to do to this cell? Depolarize it. And depolarization you know to be what kind of event? Excitatory event. And that's why this system is so weird, and you're going to have to look at it a couple times, because what is the stimulus for this cell? It's going to be light is the stimulus, but in the dark is when the cell is stimulated, right? Because that's when it's depolarizing. So this is the reverse of most kinds of receptor systems that we're familiar with, right? So in the absence of stimulus, the cell is being excited because the sodium channel is open because there's cyclic GMP around inside the cell. All right, so this is either a rod cell. Well, we're talking about a rod cell in particular. So here is one of the discs, and within the discs we have that rhodopsin molecule. All right, so here is that cis retinol, and it's in just the right configuration so that it can bind to rhodopsin. In the disc, there are also G proteins. Right, there's not a receptor-coupled G protein; it's just a G protein. Also running around inside the cell, there is something called phosphodiesterase. So let's write down the names of a couple enzymes. Can you remember what we said about adenylate cyclase? What does adenylate cyclase do? Yeah, it takes an ATP and makes a cyclic AMP out of it. That's its job. Okay. All right, well, there is a guanylate cyclase. And a guanylate cyclase will take a GMP and make a cyclic, it will take a GTP and make a cyclic GMP out of it, sort of like cyclic AMP. All right, so that is active all the time. So then how is cyclic ATP and cyclic GMP taken care of? How is it destroyed? Right, so it's built by adenylate or guanylate cyclase. But remember, a lot of these control systems are under antagonistic control, so there should be an enzyme that breaks it down, right? Just like there was a phosphatase and a kinase, right? What breaks down cyclic GMP is the phosphodiesterase breaks cyclic GMP down. So in the dark, phosphodiesterase is inactive. And so cyclic GMP sticks around inside the cell, binds to the sodium channel, allows sodium to enter the cell, depolarizing that cell and basically exciting the cell. So this cell is excited in the absence of stimulus. But let's turn a light on. Let's create some stimulus. That light is going to be absorbed by that retinol molecule, can no longer fit in that active site perfectly, and when it moves, it activates the G protein. And the subunit that moves away from the disc is the alpha subunit. It binds to a phosphodiesterase, converting it from an inactive form to an active form. And so what does an active phosphodiesterase do? It binds cyclic GMP, breaks it down to just regular old linear GMP. So it gets rid of cyclic GMP. But remember, this sodium channel over here is a ligand-gated channel. And as cyclic GMP levels go down, what happens to that influx of sodium into the cell? It stops, right? So in the presence of stimulus, the cell becomes inhibited because the sodium channel closes, right? Which is really strange. We don't see many receptors that work that way. But for this particular condition, it does. Right, so in the dark condition, the cell, this particular rod cell, is excited, and in the presence of stimulus, it is inhibited, and it's due to this balance of phosphodiesterases and guanylate cyclases because they have opposite activities. Right, and when that cyclic GMP goes away, that sodium channel closes, and if sodium can't enter the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? If sodium can't enter the cell, it repolarizes, right, or hyperpolarizes. Either way, you could think of that. All right, well, let's put a couple of these cells together. Here I see a couple of rod cells, right, here and here, and then here is a neuron. What kind of neuron by shape does this look like? Nice bipolar cell. And when we were in the central nervous system, we said there were basically three the kinds of neurons by shape, right? Multipolar, very usual kind. For sensory, it would be the unipolar. And then the bipolar, fairly rare, but in special cases, it's used in our sensory apparatuses. All right, so here I see a nice bipolar cell. And then here is that ganglion cell that communicates with the bipolar that sends action potentials to the brain, right, to the visual cortex. And we got two conditions on this slide. We got dark, okay, and then a light condition. So this first column here represents the system under what conditions? With stimulus or without stimulus? Yeah. So remember, a response loop always starts with a stimulus, and that stimulus is going to be light. I don't see any light over here, so this particular column is without light stimulus. All right, and in the dark conditions, that phosphodiesterase is inactive, so that means inside the cell, there are high levels of cyclic GMP. GMP can bind to this ligand-gated sodium channel, okay, and when it does, it opens up the channel. And that's kind of strange, too, because usually, where do we find ligands for binding to channels, intracellularly or extracellularly? Extracellularly, like on dendrites, right, cell bodies. There are ligand-gated channels, and they're sensing chemicals that are coming from another cell, so they're extracellular. But this particular ligand-gated channel is like upside down. The receptor part is inside the cell, not outside. All right, so if cyclic GMP is high, sodium enters the cell, and the sodium ATP pump is always working so that the membrane potential doesn't go too far away from normal. But nonetheless, that sodium entry depolarizes this rod cell. And you know depolarization is excitatory, and so when the cell becomes excited, what happens to release of neurotransmitter? When this cell becomes depolarized, right, then that graded potential comes down to this, what did we call that end of the terminal end of this rod cell, causing release of neurotransmitter. And that neurotransmitter communicates with this bipolar cell. The bipolar cell can tell that it's there because what does the bipolar cell have? It has receptors, okay? And then these neurotransmitters from the rod cell, okay, affect the membrane potential of this bipolar cell, right? And then if the bipolar cell is stimulated or excited, then it can release or not release neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell. All right, so in the dark condition, What about this bipolar cell? It's not releasing neurotransmitter. So what is happening to the bipolar cell when this neurotransmitter from the rod cell binds to it? Right? If the bipolar cell doesn't secrete neurotransmitter, what's happening on the other end? It's being inhibited, right? It's not depolarizing, right? So this neurotransmitter causes hyperpolarization of the bipolar cell, which takes it far away from releasing neurotransmitter. So what kind of neurotransmitter is this going to be, right? That's an inhibitory neurotransmitter, right, released in the dark from the rod cell. The inhibitory neurotransmitter hyperpolarizes the bipolar so that it doesn't secrete neurotransmitter. So in the dark, this ganglion cell is not stimulated. Right, so even though the rod cell is receiving stimulus, this ganglion cell is not in the dark. And it's all because the neurotransmitter from the rod cell is inhibitory. So when it binds to a receptor on the bipolar cell, what are some ways that the bipolar cell can be inhibited? And you have to think of ion channels. What happens to some ion channels if it's inhibited? So if it's inhibited, what happens to the membrane potential inside this bipolar cell? Does it depolarize or hyperpolarize? Hyperpolarizes, and what does that mean? Does it become more negative or less negative on the inside? More negative. So if it gets more negative on the inside, how can you do that with ions? You can allow negative ions to enter the cell, and you know a nice negative, you know an anion. What's your favorite anion? Yeah, like chlorine, right? And so that could open up chlorine channels, and that will hyperpolarize the cell. The other thing that can happen, right, is that it can close a sodium channel. There are various methods that inhibition can be accomplished, right? But maybe just think of chlorine. So here's that inhibitory neurotransmitter hyperpolarizing the bipolar cell, and that keeps the ganglion cell nice and quiet under what kind of condition? In the dark, the ganglion cell is not sending action potentials to the brain because we would like to understand that action potentials produce some kind of visual image for us, right? All right, well, let's look and see what happens in the light, right? So you can tell this second column over here is in the light. I see some light being shined on it, all right? When that happens, maybe you could go back to that previous slide, then retinol changes configuration. It activates a G protein. That G protein then activates a phosphodiesterase. And what does a phosphodiesterase do with a cyclic GMP? Does it do anything with cyclic GMP? It breaks it down to regular old GMP. And so now there's no ligand to bind to the ligand-gated sodium channel. So in light conditions, what happens to that sodium current going into the cell? It doesn't go in. So in the light condition, what happens to the rod cell? Is it inhibited or stimulated? It's inhibited, right? And when the rod cell is inhibited, of course, it doesn't release neurotransmitter. And remember, that's a inhibitory neurotransmitter. So now the bipolar cell is no longer inhibited. It will start to depolarize by itself. And when it does, it releases neurotransmitter. And this is an excitatory neurotransmitter producing graded potentials on this ganglion cell. And when that graded potential reaches voltage-gated channels, then it creates an action potential that goes into the brain. All right, so the neurotransmitter between the rod cell and the bipolar cell is inhibitory, but the neurotransmitter between the bipolar cell and the ganglion cell is excitatory. Right, and so that makes sense, that in the presence of stimulus, which is light, the ganglion cell is sending action potentials to the brain. What is not so obvious is that in the presence of stimulus, the receptor cell is going to be inhibited, like we see here. Right? So the rod cell is inhibited in the light, and because it's releasing neurotransmitter, that's what allows this ganglion cell right here to send action potentials to the brain in the presence of light. So that's basically what all those other word slides have said so far, that right, this rod cell kind of acts in the opposite way that you would think it would act. Right? Usually a receptor cell, when it stimulates, Okay, when it is stimulated, what does the receptor cell do? Yeah, it produces a depolarization, right? And we call those generator potentials. Those generator potentials somewhere can be incorporated to trigger an action potential, which goes into the brain. Okay, not so with the rod cells. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about this particular exam figure. So you probably all have looked at this figure already because it's an exam figure. So ask me some questions. Any questions on this particular figure? You're good so far? Okay. I don't know, maybe draw it out a couple times. Make sure you can see what's inhibitory, what's not inhibitory, because you go back and forth a couple times. Okay. Okay. Well, that's it for the sensory chapter. So now we're going to go into endocrine chapter. All right, so let's think about the nervous system. The nervous system is used to send information long distances in your body rapidly. All right, and those action potentials don't last for a long period of time, so that information is for short-term control of various things in your body, not long-term control. And so the duration of action of the nervous system is relatively short. The endocrine system, on the other hand, a signaling compound is released by an endocrine gland into the blood, and then it travels through the blood. And as it's traveling through the blood, I think you can see that it's much slower than an action potential traveling down an axon, right? Because an action potential or nerve impulse goes about 200 to 300 miles an hour. Your circulatory system doesn't circulate things nearly that fast. So the endocrine system takes a little bit longer to have an effect in the body, right? But that also means that it has a longer action. So for mechanisms that require a longer period of control, something that you don't want to change immediately, but just control for days and days and days, or weeks and weeks and weeks, the endocrine system is much better compared to the nervous system. All right, so let's take a look at some endocrine glands. Here is an illustration of some endocrine glands, not all of them. I think we're going to be surprised at what kind of organs are endocrine glands. Have you ever heard of an endocrine gland before, or thought of any in particular? What's a good example of an endocrine gland that you've heard of? Thyroid gland. Yeah, thyroid gland secretes a thyroid hormone, which helps regulate metabolism, basal metabolic rate. Okay. And as a matter of fact, I see the thyroid gland right here. All right, it's just below the larynx on either side of the trachea, kind of a butterfly-shaped organ. And also, the brain is an endocrine gland because the hypothalamus releases hormones. And the pineal gland, which is a part of the brain, releases hormones. Right? So don't forget, the brain is a endocrine gland. The adrenal gland on top of the kidneys is an endocrine gland because it releases, remember we talked about epinephrine, right? So that's a signaling compound released from the adrenal medulla, goes into the blood, travels everywhere in the body, but the adrenal cortex also secretes hormones that go into the blood. And the kidney right here, not drawn in on this slide, but the kidney is also an endocrine gland because it can send a signaling compound someplace. And then we got the pancreas. Maybe a lot of you are aware that the pancreas is an important endocrine gland. You also know it's exocrine because it produces digestive enzymes that go into a duct that end up in the small intestine. But it's also an endocrine gland because it secretes and releases a couple hormones that we're going to look at in this class. Right? And does anybody know some names of hormones that the pancreas releases? Insulin, yes, which helps regulate blood glucose levels, right? And blood glucose levels is under antagonistic control. So insulin decreases blood glucose is another hormone that increases blood glucose. Those working together, even though they're in opposite ways, right, helps maintain glucose concentration in just the right level. All right, so we're going to look at insulin and glucagon. And then we have some primary reproductive structures like ovary and testes. Those are endocrine glands because primarily the testes secretes testosterone, that's a male sex hormone, and a male sex, sorry, from a testes, sorry, I was pointing over here, ovary. And then an ovary produces two kinds of sex hormones, progesterone and estrogen. All right, so I'm sorry, you guys, if you feel gypped and left out. You only have one sex hormone and women have two. Okay, and we'll see why that is when we get to the very last chapter, the reproductive chapter. Okay. All right, so what the heck is a hormone? Well, you know what? Before we talked about that, let's make sure everybody knows what an endocrine gland is and an exocrine. And let's start with an exocrine gland. What the heck is an exocrine gland? Yeah, it secretes something. That's a great place to start. And it secretes something. So it produces a compound, secretes it outside the cell, and it secretes it into a duct, a tube. And that tube carries it to wherever it's going to have its action. If it's a digestive enzyme, hopefully it ends up in the digestive tract. All right. So that's an exocrine gland. So what the heck is an endocrine gland? Does not have a duct, right? So it's a gland that does not have a duct. The endocrine gland produces a compound, secretes it outside the cell, and then it goes all over the body. But how does it get all over the body if there's not even a duct to carry it anyplace? Yeah, it gets absorbed into the blood. With what kind of blood vessel? A capillary, because capillaries are the only place where exchange can take place. So that hormone gets into the circulatory system, and then it just moves by diffusion all over your body, and it will diffuse out of another capillary in some other part of your body. But how is it going to control some distant target tissue? What does a target tissue have to have in order to be sensitive to that hormone from some other place? It's got to have a receptor. That's right. So the hormone binds to that receptor and then changes the physiology of the cell as a result. Okay, so let me see if I can understand what a hormone is. It's kind of a loaded definition because you got to know what an endocrine gland is, and we sort of know that. So a hormone is secreted by an endocrine gland, right? And it travels through the blood to a distant site, some place far away in the body, and it binds to a receptor in a target tissue, and the target tissue then changes response, changes its physiology. So that's what a hormone is. Right? Substance secreted by endocrine gland into the blood, it travels to a distant location, binds to a receptor, and changes the physiology of that target cell. Right? So you got to know what an endocrine is, and a target tissue, what is a target tissue that makes it special from any other kind of tissue? Yeah, it has a receptor for something, and in this particular case, it's got a receptor for that hormone that we're thinking about. Okay, so that's a hormone. There are some parts of our body, like the hypothalamus, that releases signaling compounds into the blood. They travel to a distant location, bind to a receptor, change the physiology of those cells. Right, but in that particular case, that cell is a neuron, right? And what do we usually think a neuron releases? Neurotransmitter, right? But in this particular case, that compound gets into the blood and acts like a hormone. And so really what the hypothalamus is secreting is what we call a neurohormone because it comes from a neuron, but still it gets transported like a hormone. And its target tissues have to have receptors as well. Okay, so that's just a graphic of some types of endocrine glands that we're going to look at. All right, here is a nice table of, and it's just a partial table of endocrine glands. I think you'll have some fun looking through this. Remember I said the kidneys were an endocrine gland? And the kidneys secrete something called erythropoietin when oxygen concentration decreases in the blood. So what kind of cells do you need in the blood to carry oxygen? Yeah, red blood cells, maybe you learned that in anatomy. So the kidneys can tell when you're a bit anemic because you don't have enough oxygen in your blood. It secretes erythropoietin and it goes to bone marrow. Remember, there's two kinds. What kind of bone marrow does the erythropoietin go to? Well, it goes to all kinds, but only one kind can respond to it because it has a receptor. And that is red bone marrow, Okay, the yellow bone marrow just contains adipose tissue, and that stimulates red blood cell production, right? So the kidneys are involved with red blood cell production because it secretes a hormone. All right, some of these hormones exhibit antagonistic control, which is what we're all fond of in here. The pancreas, we just talked about insulin and glucagon, they have opposite effects, right? So that provides for precise control and balance of blood glucose levels. Right? So just kind of think out loud, what does insulin do for blood glucose? Does it increase it or decrease it? It decreases blood glucose because insulin is a passport that allows glucose to enter a cell. Without that passport, glucose can't enter the cell, and it's trapped in the blood, right? And so that's one way that we understand diabetes mellitus is if there's no insulin available, blood glucose goes high and stays high because it can't go anywhere, right? It can't get inside the cell because there's no passport to get in. On the other hand, glucagon will increase blood glucose. Well, how can we increase blood glucose? There are stores of glucose in the form of glycogen, and glucagon can go to the liver and even adipose tissue, but in the liver, glucagon will cause the breakdown of glycogen, and with the building block of glycogen, glucose, right? And then the liver will secrete that glucose into the blood. And as a matter of fact, the liver is the only organ that can secrete glucose into the blood. Every other cell, every other organ, once it absorbs glucose, it's trapped inside the cell. So all the other cells in your body are very greedy. Only the liver, right, will release it. All right, so that's for blood glucose. What about calcium? Is calcium an important molecule in our body? I don't even want to say metabolite because it's just an ion. Right, important electrolyte, that's the best way to say it, yeah. So blood levels of calcium should be regulated very precisely. And you know what? There are two hormones that are antagonistic to each other for calcium. At least we believe so. The first one, parathyroid glands. These are embedded in the thyroid gland. There's two on the right, two on the left. They're pretty small. They release parathyroid hormone. It has an effect on bone and the digestive tract and the kidneys. But the bottom line is parathyroid hormone increases calcium concentration in the blood, increases blood calcium levels. How does it do that? By enhancing the absorption of calcium from your digestive tract. That's why we have small intestine here. It also works on the kidneys, right, to help preserve calcium ions in the blood. It helps the resorption of calcium so that it's not so much as lost in the urine. Okay, so parathyroid hormone increases absorption, reduces the loss of calcium, and it also works on bone, right? And so if that calcium ends up in the blood, what happens to bone? It loses calcium, right? So bone, maybe you could think of as a reservoir of calcium where parathyroid glands can go to when blood calcium levels decrease. All right, on the other hand, there are some cells within the thyroid gland, and they release calcitonin. Calcitonin has the opposite effect, okay, and it will decrease blood calcium levels. I don't see where it says it on this slide, but it says it on this slide someplace. Calcitonin, I don't know, maybe in your book it's continuous. Okay, calcium level, blood, I don't know, it wraps around in a funny location right here. Okay. Well, I don't have to point it out to you. Calcitonin may participate in blood calcium levels. Right. So sometimes we're not so sure about that, but parathyroid increases calcium, depleting your bones, and calcitonin is a hormone that decreases blood calcium, presumably by enhancing absorption of calcium into bones, maintaining bones. So now you can see osteoporosis is what, a balance or an imbalance of parathyroid hormone and calcitonin. It's an imbalance, right? And what's in favor is the action of calcitonin, the action of parathyroid hormone, right, which helps dissolve bone down. And remember, there's two kinds of cells in bone. actually three kinds. There's osteocytes that we find in mature bone, and then there's two others. There's a kind that builds bone up, and then there's a kind that breaks bone down. Does anybody remember? Let's do the one that builds bone up. It's an osteo-something. Osteoblast builds bone, okay? And then what's the other one that breaks bone down? Osteoclast. That's right. So parathyroid hormone, calcitonin, works through the actions of those two cells. Unfortunately, it loses a little bit of regulation, precise regulation, as we get older, right? And we lose bone density as a result of that. All right, so those are only a couple of hormones I'm going to read about right now for you, but maybe we can refer to this table throughout the chapter. Let's do some chemistry first, okay? And some hormones are amine hormones, and I think we've talked about this already, norepinephrine and epinephrine, okay, monoamines. And usually you would consider these neurotransmitters, but don't forget they're released by the adrenal medulla, so they are really hormones, right? And so these are amine hormones, thyroxine and melatonin. Thyroxine is thyroid hormone, right? And melatonin, well, we don't talk much about melatonin. All right. Some are polypeptide or protein-type hormones. They're chains of amino acids. And insulin is one of those. Oxytocin, insulin and glucagon are examples of those. Antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin, right? These two hormones come from the same endocrine gland. And maybe from anatomy you would remember which one that is, I'm not so sure, but it is the pituitary. But in particular, what part of the pituitary? The posterior part, right? So oxytocin and ADH come from the posterior pituitary, and you should probably know that ADH stands for antidiuretic hormone, which is an antidiuretic, so it reduces the volume of urine that you produce. Right? A diuretic will increase, antidiuretic will reduce. All right, a couple other hormones that we're going to look at, ACTH, parathyroid hormone, and then others are glycoproteins. Right, which is like a polypeptide, but it's been modified, it's been conjugated with a sugar molecule. Some of these would be like LH, FSH, TSH, we'll talk about those. And all of these that we've pointed out so far are polar compounds. So if they're polar compounds, can they dissolve in water or not? If they're polar compounds. Dissolve in water? Say yes, because water is a polar molecule, right? Like molecules in polarity attract each other, right? So all of these hormones can dissolve in water very easily, so that makes delivery pretty simple around our body. But then there are some steroid hormones, and steroids belong to a class of chemicals that we know to be lipids. And what about lipids? Are they soluble in water? No, because they're nonpolar. Here are some examples. Testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, cortisol. These are all examples of steroids, and they're all derived from one compound, and that is cholesterol. Right? So you know cholesterol to be bad if it's in high concentration, causes cardiovascular disease, but you need some cholesterol in your body to make these various hormones. Okay? Sex hormones and other hormones that control sugar in your body and sodium as well. Those are steroid hormones. So when a steroid hormone enters the blood, they have to hop a ride on a carrier protein that helps it dissolve into the blood. Right? It just can't float around in the blood like these other hormones can. All right, so here we have the cholesterol molecule. Right, you'd probably recognize that. See like a nice staircase kind of configuration to it. And you can see with some modifications, cholesterol can be converted into progesterone. And when you look at cholesterol and progesterone, these little bends right here are just carbon atoms. Does it look like there's a major change in this molecule when you look from cholesterol to progesterone? Looks pretty doggone similar to me. The structural change is small, right? But the physiology changes a lot, right? So again, small changes in structure can produce massive changes in function. All right, progesterone can be used to make cortisol. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Progesterone can also be used to make an intermediate for testosterone. So here is testosterone. This little line is just pointing up to a methyl group. I don't think you had to know what a methyl group is in here, but it's just a CH3, right? CH3 group. So there's CH3 here, CH3 here, and OH. So that's testosterone. And then testosterone can be converted into estrogen. Right? And look at the difference between testosterone and estrogen. Only a difference of a hydrogen atom on this end of the molecule, and then also maybe a methyl group over here. That's it. So again, if you look at the difference between estrogen and testosterone, the structure of those compounds doesn't look like it's different by a lot. It doesn't look by a lot. But is there a difference in function between estrogen and testosterone? Yes, huge difference, right? Okay, so don't forget, all of these come from cholesterol with some modifications. Estrogen produced in the ovary, testosterone in the testes. And maybe and testosterone also produced in the adrenal gland. Okay, another kind of lipid hormone, besides steroids, is thyroid hormone. Because of these hydrocarbon cyclic ends of the molecule are fatty, they're nonpolar. And here is an example of thyroid hormone. And when we look at it, it contains kind of a funny element. It contains this I. What does I stand for? Iodine, right? So here is a fairly competent thyroid hormone called thyroxine. And how many iodines does it have on it? I see 4. So most times when we talk about this particular compound, right, well, very few times we call it tetraiodothreonine. Right, tetra for these 4 iodines on there. We usually just call it T4, right? But we're not talking about the vertebrae, we're talking about this particular hormone. Right? This one is not so active. When it gets inside the cell, it loses an iodine, it gets converted into triiodothreonine, but we don't say that, we just say T3. So T3 really is the active form. Thyroid gland can secrete both of these, mostly T4. All right, so some hormones need some of those special functional groups to have activity. And if this triiodothreonine didn't have 3 iodines, if it only had 2 or 1 or none, what happens to the structure of T3? Changes. And then what happens to the function? It changes, right? It won't have any function inside the body. So then you would be deficient in thyroid hormone. We'll see what happens after that. Okay, some actions of hormones. All right, both the nervous system and endocrine system uses chemicals to communicate, neurotransmitters in one case, hormones in the other. Right, the difference between neurotransmitters and hormones is how they get transported in the body, blood versus a tube. Right, and hormones have a much greater diversity of effects in the body compared to neurotransmitters. Right, neurotransmitters usually only cause 2 things. What can a neurotransmitter, the 2 things that a neurotransmitter can cause? It can cause? Yeah, how do you do excitation? Depolarization, that's right. Neurotransmitter can cause depolarization, or it can cause hyperpolarization. That's pretty much the only 2 things that a neurotransmitter can do. But what about a hormone? Well, it regulates blood glucose entry into cells. It regulates red blood cell production, right? It regulates basal metabolic rate. Just all kinds of different things that neurotransmitters can't, right? So that's another advantage of having an endocrine system. And then we learned that there are a couple chemicals that are used both as hormones and neurotransmitters, depending on the location. But here's a similarity. Both neurotransmitters and hormones, in order to have an effect on a target cell or a target tissue, they have to have a receptor. There have to be receptor proteins. And there should be a way to inactivate those signaling compounds, whether it's a neurotransmitter or a hormone, fairly rapidly so that that system doesn't get saturated, so that it can be reset. Okay, hormones. We said that there were water-soluble ones and water-insoluble ones. They're polar and nonpolar. And they have to bind to a receptor on a target cell in order to have an effect. So for the polar kind of hormone, where is that receptor going to be? And your two choices are extracellularly on the cell membrane pointing to the outside or inside the cell. Intracellular or extracellular for a water-soluble hormone. Where's that receptor going to be? Okay, some people said extracellular, and that's exactly right, but you got to know why. Why is that? Because if it's a polar compound, it can dissolve in water, but that also means it can't dissolve through the cell membrane. It's excluded, right? That's just some basic physical chemistry. So water-soluble or polar hormones have extracellular receptors, while lipid hormones like steroids have intracellular receptors. And that has something to do that's going to make their action a little bit different. Okay. Some interactions between hormones. A tissue will have a number of different kinds of receptors, right? So they will bind different kinds of hormones. And if two hormones bind to a cell and they work together to produce an effect, then they are synergistic with each other. Which means then usually that when both bind, okay, to a receptor, they produce a larger effect than if you just add up the individual effects of one hormone to the effect of the other one, right? So that means some kind of potentiation going on there. A hormone can have a permissive effect, right? And that just means before a hormone can have any effect at all, its companion has to be there, right? So the response to one hormone is completely dependent on the other one being there. That's the permissive effect. And, of course, there can be some hormones that inhibit each other, and we would call that an antagonistic effect. All right, so there's a subtle difference between permissive and synergistic. All right, let's take a look at the action of some hormones. Well, since it's binding to a receptor, we can just rely on all of our knowledge of enzymes and receptors, ligand-gated channels have a receptor. And that just means that the ligand or hormone has to have the correct shape in order to bind to the receptor, right? And if that shape changes a little bit, then it might not bind at all. It might change very rapidly, right? So that proper shape of a signaling compound is what we call specificity. So target cells, receptors have high specificity, which means very few kinds of compounds can bind to that receptor to produce a response because they don't have the right shape. They have to have exactly the right shape to fit into that something that you could consider an active site. And since the site is so specific, right, it has high affinity. So that target tissue needs very little hormone circulating in the blood, right? It's almost like these hormones are being drawn in to that binding site. And then low capacity for a hormone means that a particular target tissue doesn't have a lot of receptor sites. So very few receptors on a cell still can produce a massive effect or a significant effect of the physiology of that cell. Right? And these receptors exhibit saturation and all those other things that we were looking at before. So lipophilic, right, have cytoplasmic receptors, and some of these receptors are in the nucleus, for instance, and if it's in the nucleus, then they have an effect on transcription. What do you know about transcription? It's a part of what kind of thing? Transcription is a part of, maybe you said, but I didn't quite hear. It's a part of a two-step process. Right, protein synthesis, right? So transcription is what, the first or second step in protein synthesis? Yeah, it's the first, right? It's the beginning step, which means the other ones can follow. Right, so if these hormones bind to nuclear receptors, it changes protein synthesis inside the cell. We call that the genomic action. But that takes a while, right? Because first you have to transcribe. That means you got to open up a DNA molecule, find RNA nucleotides, put them together to make mRNA, rRNA, tRNA. They have to leave the nucleus, right, in order for translation to take place, because translation, you know, always takes place in the cytosol, right, not inside the nucleus. So you got to wait for all these things to go out, and then you need a ribosome to put all those amino acids together. So there's a fairly long lag time for those kinds of receptors to have an effect. While water-soluble receptors, told me on the surface of the cell, and I like that a lot. So if a signaling compound is trapped outside the cell, how does it change the physiology on the inside if it can't even get in? It uses a second messenger system, right? So the first messenger will be the hormone, and the second messenger will be inside the cell. And we look at some second messengers maybe already, like calcium could be a second messenger, cyclic AMP can be a second messenger, and some of these things are activated by G proteins. Remember we said G proteins are really a favorite way for signal transduction pathways across a membrane. All right, let's look at a cytoplasmic receptor or a lipophilic hormone. So here is a hormone, and it's in the blood, right? But it doesn't dissolve in the blood very readily, so it's carried by a protein that dissolves in the blood very easily. This protein, you could kind of consider this almost like a detergent, right? So it allows this lipid to dissolve into water. Some of that hormone will dissolve in water, but not very much of it. There's going to be an equilibrium that's established between the hormone concentration that's bound compared to the hormone concentration that's just floating in the blood. So what happens, okay, and let's look at this right here. I see a two-way arrow that can go both ways. All right, which arrow is going to be predominant when we take hormone, this free hormone in the blood, away? Is anything going to happen to this hormone up over here to the carrier protein? Remember Le Chatelier's principle. So if we take away this freely floating hormone, then the one on the carrier protein, it's going to have a tendency to be released to replace that that has been removed from the plasma, right? Or if we increase the amount floating around in the plasma, what happens to the amount of hormone bound to the carrier protein? It increases, right? Again, according to Le Chatelier's principle. All right, so let's track this hormone a little bit. It's a hydrophobic compound. That's why it has a carrier protein. It dissociates. There's always going to be some in the plasma, and it can diffuse into cells, a target cell, because it can diffuse through that lipid region of the phospholipid bilayer. So now it's inside the cell. Here I see a cytoplasmic receptor, and these things are what we call nuclear hormone receptors. It has two major parts to it. It has a receptor protein that binds the hormone, and then it has another region right here that can bind onto DNA. All right, so when the hormone binds to this nuclear hormone receptor, it moves into the nucleus. We call that translocation. And there it can bind to DNA. And when it binds to DNA, it can initiate transcription. What do we call something that can initiate transcription? We call it, it's a something factor. It's a transcription factor, right? So this hormone receptor bound to hormone can become a transcription factor, which initiates transcription. And, all right, so when transcription takes place, what's the first thing that's produced? Okay, transcription produces RNA. Yeah, that RNA moves into the cytoplasm, and then that messenger RNA can be used by translation to produce a protein, right? And that protein synthesis is the response of that steroid hormone, right? So that's the response. And these proteins then are going to change the physiology inside of this cell. Okay, so these nuclear hormone receptors serve as transcription factors. They activate transcription, and there's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of hormones that bind to these nuclear hormone receptors. So we say that it constitutes a superfamily. And also vitamin D and retinoic acid that we talked about previously, okay, have nuclear hormone receptors. Even though we might not want to consider vitamin D a hormone, we'll see maybe what its effect is on the endocrine system. All right, well, we need to understand nuclear hormone receptors a little bit better. All right, so here I see that hormone binding unit, right? There's a ligand binding domain, and then here's the DNA binding domain. this receptor can't bind to the DNA until the steroid hormone binds to it. And it binds to a site on DNA that we call the hormone response element. And if we look at this hormone response element on DNA, okay, does this area over here look the same as this one over here, or is there a separation between them? I see a little separation between them. And so a hormone response element actually has two sites for binding something. Each one is called a half site. Right? And if only one site is bound, then transcription won't take place. You have to have both bound to that hormone response receptor. All right. So here I see that hormone response element. It's bound to these receptors with hormones. It forms this structure of these two receptors. This is what we call dimerization. Right, so an adequate transcription factor relies on dimerization, right, to initiate transcription. In some cases, this hormone can be exactly the same hormone. In other cases, they can be different. If it's the same hormone, we call it homodimerization. Right? If they're different hormones, we call that heterodimerization. And that's why some hormones will have a permissive effect. Right? Because if you have the signaling hormone coming from your body, it binds to a half site, but without this other hormone, it won't have any effect whatsoever, right, until the other half site is bound. Right? So this other hormone over here is allowing the first one to have an effect. We call that the permissive effect. Dimerization, okay, we talked about all that already. Let's talk about the thyroid gland. It secretes mostly T4. T4 is carried in the blood. Remember, thyroid hormones are not water-soluble, so they need a carrier protein in the blood. So most of the thyroid hormone carried in the blood is T4. Right? And there's an equilibrium of T4 that's bound to that globulin. Globulins basically carry things around in the blood for us. It's a protein. And so there is an equilibrium between the T4 that's bound to the globulin and the small amount that's freely dissolving in plasma. But it's only the free that can enter cells, dissolve through the cell membrane. Okay, not the one that is bound, we talked about already. Now, once T4 is in the cell, it's converted it to T3, and then T3 is the one that can bind to the receptor protein, and this particular receptor is in the nucleus, not the cytosol. All right, so what do you think the effect of T3 is going to be on the cell if the receptor is inside the nucleus? Is it going to change any electrical property of the nucleus? Going to have an effect on ion channels, perhaps. But what does a nucleus contain? The blueprint to make proteins, right? And so T3 acts as a transcription factor so that that cell can produce different kinds of proteins that change the physiology of the cell. All right, so here is that hormone response element, and we see that in one case, one half site has to be bound to the triiodothreonine receptor and the other one, retinoic acid, before it can act as a competent transcription factor. And so we call this heterodimerization. In this particular case, T3 cannot have an effect on the cell until, right, retinoic acid binds to its receptor. So retinoic acid has a permissive effect on the expression of T3 or the regulation of T3, that retinoic acid has to be there. Okay, cell surface receptors, right, have to work through a second messenger system. The hormone is always the first messenger. The second messenger carries a signal from the receptor to the inside of the cell. And here is a really good example of a second messenger system. All right, so here's the extracellular space, here's intracellular, and this shape right here should remind you of something. A G protein coupled receptor, right? And so the receptor spans all the way across the membrane. The binding site is extracellular, right? But some of the active site of this particular protein is intracellular or within the membrane, and that's where the G protein binds to it. So when the hormone binds to the receptor that activates the G protein, allows dissociation. In this particular case, this alpha subunit can move around right inside the surface, sometimes on the outside surface of the cell membrane, and it can bump into other proteins that are dissolved in the membrane. And this particular one is adenylate cyclase. And we talked about that a little bit earlier. What does adenylate cyclase do? Takes an ATP and makes cyclic AMP out of it. Right, so here is cyclic AMP, and here's a little leftover product. Pyrophosphate, we're not ever going to be concerned with that. But here is cyclic AMP produced by adenylate cyclase. All right, so then after adenylate cyclase produces a cyclic AMP, what happens to it since it's an enzyme? Does it get used up in this reaction? It does not, right? This enzyme does not, enzymes, remember, are catalysts. They don't get used up in the reaction. The only thing in the catalyzed reaction is that a reactant is converted into product, but the enzyme stays the same. So after adenylate cyclase makes one cyclic AMP, guess what it can do? It can make a second and a third and a fourth, right? It can make many cyclic AMPs in a short period of time, right? So here we have one signaling molecule outside the cell producing many, many, many second messengers inside the cell. Right, that's a special process. And what do we call that? I think I mentioned it at one time. That is a level of amplification, where one small signal outside the cell can produce a very large signal inside the cell as a result of using a G protein coupled receptor and an enzyme that is in the membrane. Okay, so that's a level of amplification. Cyclic AMP can bind to a protein kinase. Ooh, what does a kinase do? It adds a phosphate, usually from ATP, to another compound somewhere. Normally, this enzyme, this protein kinase, is inactive because it has some kind of other subunit on it, usually acting allosterically at some other site than the active site. But when cyclic AMP binds to that inhibitory subunit, it no longer can fit on the protein kinase, so it comes off. And then that leaves the protein kinase by itself, and now it is active. Right? And this protein kinase is going to phosphorylate. Could be a number of different kinds of proteins inside the cell. And when it phosphorylates a protein, it can increase the activity of it or decrease the activity of it. It just all depends. All right, but what about protein kinase when it catalyzes a reaction? Does it get used up? What about an enzyme? Does an enzyme ever get used up in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction? Yeah, it doesn't. So this protein kinase just doesn't phosphorylate one protein, but it can do it again and again and again and again. All right, so one cyclic AMP can produce many activated enzymes. What do we call that? A level of amplification. And what do you call it when you have multiple levels of amplification? Right, the first one, adenylate cyclase. Second one, protein kinase. We call that a cascade mechanism, right? There's a cascade mechanism. So a cascade mechanism can allow a very small signal outside the cell to become a massive signal inside the cell, but also have it happen rapidly. So it helps speed up the control of this target tissue. All right, so adenylate cyclase system. Am I going backwards? Okay, I think we... Oh, here's one other thing. All right, so adenylate cyclase makes cyclic AMP. But remember, we said that we would like to be able to reset this mechanism. Right? If we make cyclic AMP, we don't want it sticking around inside your cell for your entire lifetime, because then this hormone will never be able to affect the physiology anymore. And so what kind of enzyme will break down cyclic AMP? The same one that breaks down cyclic GMP. It is a phosphodiesterase, right? And phosphodiesterase might be continuously active inside the cell, and then there's a balance between adenylate cyclase and phosphodiesterase that controls the level of cyclic AMP. And again, that is antagonistic control. So cyclic AMP doesn't stay around inside the cell forever because there is phosphodiesterase in there. All right, here is another second messenger system. What is similar with this one compared to that first one that we looked at? G protein coupled receptor, that's right. So here's the first messenger, the hormone, right? Activates the G protein, and in this particular case, it doesn't bump into adenylate cyclase, it bumps into phospholipase. And this is probably like the third one somebody discovered. It's embedded in the cell membrane, doesn't go across the cell membrane, it's inside, it's more in the lipid region of the phospholipid bilayer. And phospholipase C can take a phospholipid and make another compound out of it called IPI3, inositol 3-phosphate. We never talk about it like that. We just say IPI3 or IP3. So IP3 is building up inside the cell. IP3 can bind to the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and there are ligand-gated channels there, and that opens up a calcium channel. And you know that endoplasmic reticulum can store calcium, right? There are calcium pumps that will pump, active transport pumps that will take calcium in the cytosol, put it in the endoplasmic reticulum. But when that calcium channel opens up, then there's this huge gradient of calcium. Calcium leaks out into the cytoplasm, and that calcium, right, can change the physiology of that cell. So tell me, where is the first messenger? Hormone. What's the second messenger? IP3, IP3 is the second messenger because IP3 is always inside the cell, but calcium is also a second messenger because you find it always where? Inside the cell, not extracellularly. Only thing you see outside the cell is the hormone. All right, well, how on earth? Okay. There's something interesting I want to say about this. All right, so here you see the structure of the membrane. And we've seen in many chemical reactions that water participates in that chemical reaction. Sometimes it actually adds itself or subtracts itself from a metabolite. You could consider water in some sense a metabolite as well as the solvent that our body is dissolved in. Here is something interesting. Where does the substrate for phospholipase come from? The surrounding structure around it. So it uses the membrane itself to make a second messenger. All right, so these phospholipids not only are part of the structure, but they're important signal transduction process using G protein coupled receptors. Just the structure of the membrane allows that to happen. Okay, there's another second messenger that's common, and that's called diacyl glycerate, and we just call that DAG, D-A-G. And that can open calcium channels as well. All right, so what's the effect of calcium? I think we talked about a molecule that has a high affinity for calcium, and it's called calmodulin. We talked about that one. So calmodulin binds calcium, and the second part of that word, modulin, means that it's going to modulate something or regulate something inside the cell. Calcium bound to calmodulin can activate a protein kinase, which then can go around and phosphorylate other kinds of enzymes inside the cell. And remember, these are just levels of amplification. So this calcium-calmodulin complex acts in what kind of mechanism producing the hormone's effect? Is it just amplification? It produces a cascade mechanism, right? So that this calcium-calmodulin complex produces a cascade mechanism to very efficiently and quickly produce the hormone's effect because it activates various levels of enzymes inside the cell. Well, I think we need to look at a real-world example. And I'll talk about this slide. Here we have a liver cell, right, this nice square cell over here, and we know that liver can make glycogen and can break glycogen down. All right, what is the process where a liver cell can take a glucose and make glycogen out of it? That's glycogenesis, that's right. The liver cell can also take glycogen and snip off a glucose from it. That is glycogenolysis, that's right. Okay, so here's that liver cell. involved in this particular case, glycogenolysis. And remember, the liver cell has a glucose-6-phosphatase, meaning it can take this phosphate group off, and then free glucose can enter the rest of your body through the circulatory system. Only kind of tissue that will do that. All right, so how is this secretion of glucose into the blood controlled? Well, we see a couple of different kinds of adrenergic receptors. There's a beta adrenergic receptor and also an alpha adrenergic receptors, right? And epinephrine will bind to these. And let's take a look and see what happens. All right, so if the beta adrenergic receptor binds epinephrine, that activates an adenylate cyclase. How on earth can that happen? How on earth can this epinephrine that's outside the cell activate adenylate cyclase? Through a G-protein coupled receptor, right? So that G-protein coupled receptor activates adenylate cyclase, converts ATP into cyclic AMP, that can activate a protein kinase, right? Because maybe it removes that inactivation unit. And now this kinase will work on glycogen, which contains just glucose. And what does a kinase do? Adds a phosphate to it. So here you now have a glucose with a phosphate on it, and that is glucose-1-phosphate, right? So this protein kinase, which we've been just kind of waving our hands about, you can see degrades glycogen into glucose by phosphorylating, right? So that's one part. And then here is the alpha adrenergic receptor. When epinephrine binds to it, it opens up a calcium channel. And where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell, right? And or it could work through a G-protein coupled receptor to open up calcium channels on endoplasmic reticulum. In any case, the concentration of calcium is going to increase inside the cell. That's going to bind to calmodulin. And remember, calmodulin, when it's bound to calcium, can modulate the activity of enzymes inside the cell. And in this particular case, it's going to activate protein kinase. Protein kinase inside the cell is going to have what effect on glycogen? It's going to break it down, phosphorylate a glucose, right, because it's a kinase. Right, so now you have glucose-1-phosphate, and with the phosphatase, it can become a free glucose and secreted from the cell. All right, so here are two different examples of second messenger systems that help maintain what in the blood? Blood glucose levels, right, which is important. And in what state, okay, are these two second messenger systems activated? In what state is the liver going to secrete glucose into the blood? Fasted state, good. Yeah, you have to go back to a previous week in the class to remember that. Fasted state, not the fed state, because in the fed state, where is this blood glucose coming from? From, your intestines. Okay. All right, I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to this slide. I see a phospholipid bilayer right here. You see that? And then I see a couple proteins that go all the way across the membrane. Right, so these are nice integral proteins. And they look kind of like mirror images of each other. And there's an active site on both of them. And I also see a signaling compound that's, this one is trapped outside the cell, right? This is just a polypeptide, insulin. And what do we know the action of insulin to be? Decreases blood glucose, right? We said insulin acts as a passport for glucose to enter a cell. So we're going to pay attention to that and see how that works. Okay, this receptor right here is what we call a tyrosine kinase receptor. So once it becomes activated, what does a kinase do? It adds a phosphate. Okay, and it's going to add a phosphate to a tyrosine amino acid on some protein someplace, but only that one tyrosine element of a protein. So when insulin is present, it's going to cause dimerization, right? We kind of looked at dimerization in terms of those nuclear hormone elements, right? So one insulin molecule can cause dimerization of this tyrosine kinase receptor, and when it's dimerized, then that form can take an ATP and phosphorylate itself, right, and takes two ATP to do that. And when that happens, then the tyrosine kinase activity of this dimer can become activated. Right? So now you have an activated tyrosine kinase, and it can phosphorylate a number of other kinds of molecules inside the cell and then change the activity of, if it's an enzyme, it can turn an enzyme on, turn an enzyme off. But in any case, if there's many levels of amplification, what do we call that? A cascade. That's right. So I think the bottom line for this slide is that when insulin binds to a tyrosine kinase receptor, it produces a cascade of effects because there are multiple enzymes that can become activated, like we see right here, and that's going to promote glucose uptake, and it's also going to regulate anabolism inside the cell. But I think the take-home message here is that insulin binding to tyrosine kinase produces a cascade of effects, which produces a massive uptake of glucose from the blood, right? Because a cascade contains many levels of amplification. Okay, so I think the sign-in sheet is going around someplace, and when we're going to start next time is with this thing right here. And we're still talking about insulin, because here I see that tyrosine kinase receptor for insulin.